and welcome to the Sisters, Brothers, Friends, Comrades. It's, as you may well hear, you so you know the title, Sacrifice, Sons, Colonialism, Neoliberalism, and Climate Change. Or as I could have called it, Deciding Who Lives and Who Dies. So my name is Asa Grimm and I'm from War on Want. War on Want is a radical international charity whose founding slogan is poverty is political and justice not charity. And of course, that the only war worth fighting is the war against want. And those have been our guiding principles and the reason our work focuses on the root causes of poverty, human rights violations and injustice. And we've been at the forefront of solidarity with our movements in the global south, first against colonialism and imperialism, and today against neoliberalism, neocolonialism, and climate injustice. We don't do aid or handouts. What we do is we engage in practical solidarity with our movements around human rights, workers' rights against extractivism for food sovereignty, and defending the right of people to have a dignified life. We were founded by the labour movement and we're rooted in the labour movement, but we work and we organise alongside, of course, workers, but climate justice groups, migrant and refugee organisations, youth groups here in the UK to fight the structural systems of oppression, economic, social, racial and political. And whether that means taking on the role of UK companies in creating environmental injustices and human rights violations, or calling out and targeting our own government for its complicity in war and conflict, to working on migrant rights, to tackling precarious contracts. I'm proud to say we were the only charity that actively backs the strikers in their campaign and actively backing them on October 4th, so when we have the coordinated day of action and strikes by workers in McDonald's, Wetherspoons and TGI Fridays. We see ourselves very much as an intersectional movement that connects our fights, our resistance, and has a vision that a better world is possible. And we see ourselves also as part of a global movement for justice. And we really believe that power comes from organising our movement and being able to tell, willing to tell the truth to power, of believing the power of our own agency, and of course refusing to accept that there is no alternative. But most of all, and most importantly, that we have to act both locally and globally. But ultimately, we must be accountable to our movements and to our fellow brothers and sisters on the front lines in the global south. So let me start by saying a few words just about the notion of sacrifice zones, in case you haven't heard that word or that term before. It was first coined actually in the United States, and it was coined to explain how whole geographical areas and people within them, mainly poor, Hispanic and black, were facing multiple impacts of environmental injustices. So much so that life expectancy was between 10 and 20 years below the national average. And these injustices, of course, were closely linked to economic deprivation and to political invisibility. And people and communities were trapped in an endless cycle of poverty, powerlessness and despair, sacrificed at the altar of economic greed. And an American journalist called these places sacrifice zones, and he said these are areas that have been destroyed for quarterly profit, environmentally destroyed, communities destroyed, human beings destroyed, families destroyed. He went on to say there is absolutely nothing within the formal mechanisms of power and governance to stop this destruction. However, sacrifice zones are not fixed geographical locations, but I would argue, and we would argue, have been an essential reality for the majority of the world's population. They could connect the global crisis of climate change, of inequality and forced displacement, of how colonialism and neoliberalism has calculated that whole parts of the world's citizens can be are being sacrificed as an essential cost, of course, to maximising their profit. We're joined today with a very, very distinguished panel, leading black voices from the global south and the UK, who will be exploring that logic of sacrifice zones within colonialism, neoliberalism and climate change. So I'll start just by giving a quick intro first to our panel. We have Vijay Prashad, who's the director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. He's also the chief editor of Leftward Books and writes incredible books, and more importantly, as he said, he really is a communist, and a lifelong member of the Communist Party in India, but one of the leading voices of our movement in the Global South. We're also joined by Feroz Manji, who is the former chief editor of Pambazuka Press, originally from Kenya in Africa. He's a writer, an activist, and also a general troublemaker. He's written profusely about African revolutions. He's, if you haven't seen this book, pick one of his books up, which is his book about the legacy of Amir Cabral, No Claim, No Easy Victories. We're also joined by Zita Holborn, who's artist, activist, black anti-racist, trade unionist, many, many different things. She is chair of Barrack UK. She's the joint national chair of Artists Union. She's also the Public Services Union Vice President. And then, last but not least, is our friend Lida Fernandez, who was from Colombia, was formerly one of the organisers of the Hemispheric Social Alliance, one of the most important social movements that came together across Latin America. It currently is working for Transnational Institute and works around environmental injustices. We were also meant to have our good friend Dr. Shivan Carter with us, who was a senior scientist at the Stockholm Environment Institute, who was coming over from the United States, but Virgin just cancelled his flight, and he's not able to join us. So if you'll forgive me for talking a little bit more, maybe I will just say a few words maybe about the climate context that I won't do justice as Shivan would have done, but I think it's worth us saying a few words just to locate where we are. So we all know that raising global temperatures by just 1 degree has been enough to melt half the summer ice in the Arctic, kill off huge swathes of the world's corals, and of course unleash killer floods and droughts. And really, the time has long passed when you needed to be a climate scientist to know that there's something very, very wrong going on in the world that we live in. I'm originally from Pakistan. In Pakistan this year, we had temperatures which hit 53.5 degrees centigrade. That is literally at the upper end of what a human being can tolerate out in the open. We had a similar heat wave in 2015, and 1,200 people died in one city alone. And in my country, Pakistan, in 2010, one flood affected 20 million people, covered one-fifth of the country, and caused $43 billion worth of damage. And this is a country where 4 out of 10 people face multiple dimensional poverty. That literally means where one shock pushes people who are barely surviving to not surviving at all. And of course, this is not the story of just one country. It's actually the story of devastation that's taking place all across the world. And we look at, and I'm sure Feroz will touch on this, but we look on the Sahel in sub-Saharan Africa, where a drought has affected 23 million people, displaced 3.5 million people. Droughts are now a reality ravaging the Horn of Africa and Southern Africa. You may have seen the pictures, of course, in the last few days of the Philippines and the floods that have been taking place in the Philippines. You may remember Typhoon Haiyan in 2013, where one typhoon killed 7,000 people and made 2 million people homeless. Of those 2 million people, only 1% of those people have been rehoused since that hurricane. And the reality is, of course, that extreme storms have now become a yearly reality, causing widespread damage. Pictures of Dominica and Puerto Rico have filled our screens over Christmas, and the majority of the people in those countries are still lack the basic amenities. The list is absolutely endless. Some people talk about that 700,000 of our fellow citizens are already losing their lives because of the impacts of climate change, while millions of more people lose their homes and livelihoods. So you have to ask yourself, if all this is all true, why haven't those in power actually done something to woken up to the scale of the challenge? And I tell you, if you go now, if you get your phone and you can Google, you know, the websites of the UK government, of the big environmental NGOs, of even the Labour movement, you do not get a sense that we're in a planetary emergency. You do not get a sense that it's all hands on deck. And of course, part of that responsibility lies with the environment movement itself, because this was a movement that was largely northern-based. And it depoliticised an issue, a climate change, from the beginning. From the 1970s, when climate change first became an issue, people in the environment movement really saw it as And they adopted, and many of them still adopt, and I'm glad some have started to change that, a theory of change which was what they would call an elite theory of change, that you had to just make the rational argument to governments about what the issue was, you produce some research, and that governments would act rationally and do the right thing. And of course, the reality is that didn't happen. And I, in my previous life, have sat through many of those meetings between NGOs and governments. And I have to say, it was very, very difficult at times to tell the difference between who was in the government and who was in the NGOs. Many of the people shared the same socio-economic background. They talked about the same language. They were pally. They shared. They went off after meetings to socialise together. They had a common language and a narrative. And, of course, I was the only non-white person in the room. And I was always told, you're just too radical. You have to compromise when you're in these meetings. And of course, it's easy to compromise when you're not sacrificing your own lives or the lives of your own community and their interests. And that's largely why, and I'm not anything against polar bears, but why for a long time the symbol of climate change was, of course, the white polar bear on the white iceberg, invisibilizing the people who were the real victims of climate change in the global south. And it's this notion of sacrifice zones which actually led to this adoption of this thing, the 2-degree centigrade guardrail that we're told is really important, that we've got to prevent a breach. It actually has absolutely no bearing in climate science at all. It was a number that was picked out of the air by European policymakers because they thought it would not damage business as usual. And in the process, of course, what they were willing to do was sacrifice everybody who has been impacted by every single 0.1 degree of warming. And it's the same logic that led to all those wild celebrations that you may have seen a couple of years ago in the Paris climate talks, when people said, amazing, we've done so much, we've prevented catastrophic climate change. Well, the reality is, in that Paris agreement, the pledges that governments have made to cut emissions will lead to, and this is what the UN says, at least 3 degrees warming or up to 7 degrees warming by the end of the century. And if we look at the devastation that's taking place at 1 degree warming, we know what the reality is. And the demand from the social movements in the global south was, of course, temperatures keep well below 1.5. And it was not because 1.5 was safe. It was 1.5, and the call from the movements was 1.5 to barely stay alive. And yet, of course, and the great irony, of course, within climate change is that it's those who are the least responsible who are being the most impacted. The richest 10% of the world are responsible for 50% of global emissions, while the poorest 50% of the world are responsible for only 10% of global emissions. And yet, we see poorer countries doing much, much more to cut emissions than richer countries. The UK, the European Union, the United States, Japan, Russia, most of them are doing about 1/5 of their fair share of tackling climate change. And the reality, of course, is now that climate change is not only inequity in itself, it fans all other existing inequalities and injustices around the world. So from whether you're from Somalia, Darfur, or Syria, or sub-Saharan Africa, the long-term effects of water, scarcity, agricultural crisis, drought, means that the reality is that more and more people find that they're unable to sustain themselves and their communities, forcing people to be internally displaced, contributing to ongoing conflicts that we're seeing across many nations. And just to tell you this, what scientists have predicted and researchers predicted, they predict a massive decline in the viability of food crops, critical for human survival. Just the extra 0.5 degree between 1 degree and 1.5 degree will mean that corn yields in Africa will be cut by half. It means that in Asia, where nearly 60% of the world's population, over 4 billion people reside, including 7 of the 10 most populous countries, that the reality of climate displacement now has become a reality. And it's not just the small islands, and it's absolutely tragic, of course, that we're losing many of the small islands in the Pacific. It's actually the impacts on Asia, on Africa, on Latin America. It's the impacts on 30 million people in Bangladesh alone, in the Bangladesh Delta. So how are people making these calculations about who lives and dies? And I'm told, and it's again an analogy that I hear a lot in the environment movement, you know, we're all on the Titanic, and the Titanic has hit the proverbial iceberg, and that sums up climate change, because we're all being impacted. And of course, ultimately, all of us will be impacted by climate change. But the reality is that the citizens of the rich industrialized countries are on the top deck of the Titanic, still sipping cocktails, listening to the orchestra, hoping that there's going to be some technological answer and miracle that will keep us alive. While in the hold of the Titanic are the poor and the black people of the global south, who when they try and escape the rising water, find that the hold is locked shut. So if that is the truth, you know, how and why isn't climate change become such an important issue for us in the Labour movement and in the broader progressive movement? And that, for this, we're going to be our distinguished panel are going to try and talk about how that arc of from colonialism to neoliberalism, right through to the reality of what we're seeing now, both in terms of the refugee, so people use the word crisis, I don't like to use the word refugee crisis, the forced displacement of people and the fact that we're willing to watch thousands of people drown in the Mediterranean each year. You may have seen in a picture in a newspaper article in The Guardian today, which talked about a new IPCC report, which is the International Panel on Climate Change. It's about to produce a report on 1.5 at a meeting in the next couple of months. And they have, in this report that is going to government, they have stripped out the seriousness of the need to take urgent action, because they say, well, the big polluters, the countries that are most polluting, the US, Australia, don't want that reality to even be in the science reports. That's the scale of our challenge, and now I hope where our contribution then will open up to the floor for your questions and answers. Vijay.
Good afternoon. Mic okay? Okay. Good afternoon. Nice to be here. The city of slavery. I wanted to start with a parable from James Baldwin. I hope very much you read James Baldwin. If you don't know who he is, you should write his name down and go and find a book by him. Baldwin talks about two people in a room. And under a table in that room, there is a dead body. I know that there's a dead body there. The other person in the room knows there's a dead body there. I know that the other person knows that there's a dead body there. The other person knows I know there's a dead body there. But we don't talk about the dead body. And then Baldwin says, this is essentially the road to permanent silence. One of the interesting things about Europe is, if I was to write the upside down dictionary, a synonym for the word Europe would be hypocrisy. And I would say that in Britain, this is raised to a high art. I know that this evening there's going to be a thing about colonialism. And I recognize that in Britain now, people are doubting that colonialism was a bad thing. It's extraordinary. This is not amnesia, this is hypocrisy. It has to be properly filed under the correct synonym. After all, the West is always surprised when there are tragedies. The West produces tragedies and then is horrified by their outcome. Millions of people are crossing the Sahel. The French have decided to move Europe's border from the north of the Mediterranean to the south of the Sahara. It's called G5 Sahel. There are French American troops that are garrisoning Africa, inside Africa, to prevent human beings from making their rightful transit across the planet Earth. Because Europe has decided that these refugees are a problem. Europe has decided that the refugees are producing a crisis. The refugees are the author of the crisis. That is Europe's decision to see it like this. Because Europe is horrified that the barbarian is coming through the gates. But of course we know that at the same time, as these human beings are trying to enter Europe, whatever that is, what is Europe? It's a fantasy idea, Europe. Continents are fantasy ideas, friends. Britain, what is this thing? Great. How did you colonize my country? You are such a small island, you have such bad weather. We gifted it to you for 300 years. These human beings are coming in this direction, but what are you sending in the other direction? And I think this bears a lot of consideration. One of your major companies is BAE Systems. You are selling arms. Arms that are destroying countries like Yemen. War is an incredibly powerful producer of carbon emissions, the destruction of environment. You know, you don't generally think of warfare as a major producer of climate change. We like to think of other things, you know, maybe recycling is going to be the antidote. If I am morally better than my neighbor, carbon will decrease. But war is a major author of this climate disaster, not to speak of the disaster on humanity. And BAE Systems is very much part of this project of destroying the world. Now, the fact is that we all know that BAE Systems' profits are beneficial to some people in Britain. After all, former Labour Prime Ministers, Tony Blair and so on, they were essentially public relations for BAE Systems. It's not just Britain, by the way. Switzerland, talk about hypocrisy, always sneers at the rest of the world. They are so superior to everyone. It has one of the most racist policies in terms of citizenship and immigration. Switzerland, Syngenta, you've not heard of this company. Syngenta sells fertilizers banned inside Europe. All around the world, Syngenta. This is the same fertilizer that farmers in India, 300,000 of them in the last 15 years, have used to commit suicide. They've drunk this fertilizer because their input costs are too high and because the International Monetary Fund has said that India cannot provide support prices to farmers. Syngenta, a Swiss company, the polite Swiss, 11 people a day die in Brazil because of this pesticide. You know, this pesticide is sold to people, fertilizer sold to people in canisters. Public Eye, which is a Swiss investigative reporting arm, has just done a superb report where they've showed that in Yavatmal, Maharashtra, little children use these same fertilizer jars to fill water, drinking water. You see, on the one hand, the IMF tells our countries, don't educate your population. In other words, cut public spending for education. And on the other side, they say, import fertilizers. But put these together. What you're getting is environmental destruction in Yavatmal and chemical warfare against children. Let's call it what it is. Tony Blair went to an illegal war against Iraq on the pretext of chemical warfare. But the British government, the Swiss government, the American government have been conducting chemical warfare against people all across the planet, except in Europe. Because in Europe you'll have high standards. In Europe you can't sell this stuff. Sell it there. That entire zone, friends, is the sacrifice zone. Everybody in that zone is easily to be dispensed. You are upset about the war in Syria. And you are rightfully upset about the deaths there. But why are you not upset about 300,000 Indian farmers who committed suicide? Why is that number not seize you? Because, you see, our media has failed us, or rather, they've succeeded in doing what the oligarchs of the world want them to do. They distract us. They make it impossible to see these structural conditions where European firms make immense amounts of profit. Syngenta is worth $43 billion, US dollars. The farmers in Yavatmal are worth nothing. They are the ones taking loans to buy this stuff. The media has done a terrific job, including The Guardian, has done a terrific job in saying, look at this war, it's terrible. Assad is a butcher. But meanwhile, over here, there are no butchers in Europe. The CEO of Syngenta, she's a very nice lady. She's a scientist, actually. She's not a butcher. Butchers are the barbarians over there. It's so easy for you to walk around saying, this is a butcher, that's a butcher. They're always outside. Idi Amin, you know, you make a list. What about your butchers? When are you going to use that term to refer to CEOs of these companies that are prosecuting chemical warfare against the planet? It's one thing to talk about climate change, and I'll end with this. It's one thing to talk about climate change in the abstraction. In other words, to talk about 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 1.5 degrees, these are abstractions. It's one thing to talk about these in terms of abstractions. But we need a strategy. We need a proper understanding of who are the culprits. This is not entirely structural domination in the way capitalism, you know, structurally dominates society. There are actually culprits here. There are actually firms that are profiting from the destruction of the planet. And many of those firms are headquartered in the West. And I would say to you, as sensitive, good people, spending a nice gloomy Sunday inside this building bizarrely known as Blackie. Bizarre. Don't understand the history of this, my friends, but anyway, it's Britain. You are sensitive people, you are sitting here. Make this party, which is having its conference nearby, make this party understand that however far it has journeyed inside British corporate power, if it wants to be a legitimate, let's forget left-wing party, a legitimate social democratic party, it has to stand for the people of the world. This is not possible nowadays to have a social democratic party in the West that is mainly concerned with domestic issues. It is not possible. Because your domestic issues impact the rest of the world. If here profits of big firms increase, it's going to allow a social democratic government to tax that company and not do the school cuts. But do you want that money inside your country based on the blood of others to improve the domestic conditions? That is what I want to put to you. Thanks.
Assad began by saying, sacrifice zones is who lives and who dies. I'd like to modify that a little, a lot. It's not just who lives, who dies, But who has a sufficiently profound understanding of the nature of dehumanization that can actually lead to protest, transformation, and a real establishment of a universalist humanity? Because we cannot simply think in pitiful terms of people dying and so on. Of course, that moves us. But we have to understand the underlying political issues that emerge out of that. And that is what I want to speak about a little this afternoon. Yesterday, I had the most amazing experience. I went on a slavery tour of Liverpool, and I was just stunned by the fact that this city is not just the city associated with slavery, but this is the basis upon which capitalism in England, in Britain, developed, and which led the source of and set the infrastructure for the colonization of the world and its continuity. I think there's a tendency for people to talk about colonialism as something in the past. This is something that continues to exist. I was struck by being taken to a garden in front of this immense building built by one of the slave owners, where there was a garden, and we were standing on the grass on the graves of former slaves. Not one name was there. Around the walls were the names of the European fighters, acknowledgement of the people who Britain fought against. There were tributes to all kinds of other white people, but not a single name. And when I walk around this city, I'm amazed at the silences of that. The question is, why? And people talk about neoliberalism today as if this is something new. And I want to try and reassess for you an understanding of what neoliberalism is politically. Because if we are to challenge it, and if we are to have solidarity with those who are engaged in struggles against it, we have to understand its real nature. Democracy. Ha! This is what Britain always boasts about, what America boasts about. But when was democracy born, and how was it born? It was liberalism itself was a product of enlightenment. And liberalism was born out of enlightenment as a twin of racism. Enlightenment was only possible because of that whole period of enslavement of Africans, of the genocide of the indigenous populations of the Americas. Those two aspects were the foundation stones of Western democracy. Because when it was born in the United States, it was a democracy for white male slaveholders. They were the only ones who were allowed to vote. They were the only ones allowed to vote. And every single gain that these people tell us we are granting you because of our liberal attitudes, every single one of them was a result of mass struggles. Women were denied the vote. They were not given it. They fought for it. In every single situation, it has always been the mass mobilization, the protests, the ones who are excluded. Liberalism created two zones. It created the sacred zone wherein democracy of the privileged could be practiced. and the profane zone, which we'll come to, and its relationship with the sacrifice zones, was where the rest were excluded. And that has been a fundamental feature of the last 200 years, certainly, but I think longer than that if we talk about the whole period of capital accumulation from slavery. So the whole period of colonialism, which arose out of the slave trade, the genocides that were carried out in Africa as well as in Latin America and elsewhere, all of these were involved the creation of a profane zone, a sacrifice zone. This is not new. The killings, the destruction of the environment, and critically, the commitment to allow the corporations to rule. And I think this is something that is often forgotten, that the colonial ventures were fundamentally driven by and organized in on behalf of the massive corporations. That was what liberalism was about. So what is neoliberalism about? Neoliberalism, in my view, is a return under new conditions of the same philosophy, and that is that in the situation where there is a political crisis of capital, indeed perhaps linked to its economic one, but a political crisis which requires that we create a world in which there are sacrifice zones, that there is no such thing as unemployment in the future. There's only never employment. And if you look at most of African countries, if you look at most third world countries, we have been living for the last 50 years under conditions where there are vast sectors of the population, 80% in Kenya certainly, who have no home, who have no income, who have a precarious existence. These are the dehumanized populations of the world. And that is the clue to my argument, that it is those who are dehumanized who have, because of that dehumanization, the most profound understanding of what it actually means to be human, to have an understanding of what it means to invent what it means to be human. And I think that's a very critical point, because we cannot simply talk about the disaster that is existing in many parts of the third world because people have been are being crushed, are being thrown into the slag heap of history. But these are places where also people are organizing, people are beginning to, and have for many years, actually begun to organize and give expression to how to fight for liberation. And I think one of the difficulties we have is that in Europe there's a tendency to assume that the European experience of democracy, of philosophy even, is the only one that's relevant. You read the books about revolutions, you talk about the American Revolution, you talk about the Paris Revolution, but the silences over things like the Haitian Revolution and Toussaint Louverture. Why was that important? Because it was a classic example of a universalist, inclusive universality that was expressed in that revolution. Whereas the French Revolution was essentially defined within the parameters of, oh, only us, the rest is excluded, the Haitian Revolution made it very clear that any humans who were involved in the struggle for liberation became African. Toussaint Louverture's announcement at the victory was precisely to say, even those Spanish and German mercenaries who fought with the slaves were now African. And that is a really important issue, because that is what it means to try to say an inclusive humanity is something that we have to fight for. But in that, I think one of the things we have to be clear about is that it is not simply in the third world, it is not simply in Africa or in Asia that this is happening. It is in this country, there are sacrifice zones that exist and growing. There are people here who are being thrown out into the dustbin of history. And I think some connection between that experience and the experience of those in the ghettos of Africa is where that connection needs to be made.